Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for May 4th, the 4th. May the 4th be with you. It's the first podcast of May. And so in the spirit of giving and the holiday of Star Wars, this is like a national holiday now.
May the 4th.
Where Santa Palpatine comes.
Where that guy say, yeah, comes down, beams down from the Death Star to give you something.
Give you presents under your
dehumidifier.
We're going to do, because we can't really agree on what to do, we're going to do quick takes of our whatever we like.
Yeah. We talked about how you should be of one flesh union last week, and now we're going to demonstrate that we can't agree on even simple things like what to talk about in a podcast.
And I know we said that we were going to give advice for how to cope if you're single and lonely, but we realized we don't really have any idea about how to do that.
We have some ideas, but
maybe we could do them later.
Yeah, we'll do them later.
I don't know.
We're not of one mind today, so we're having, you want to talk about cannibalism, and I want to talk about Anglicanism, and so we're having a hard time giving advice to lonely people.
Or any people. I also had a question about how to stay Calvinist when you hate Calvinism. And I don't have a lot of advice on that either. That question? I can't remember.
That would be one of my takes. Who was it? Someone,
a really nice person who reads me and okay. Who feels...
Who agrees with the doctrine but hates the people?
Well, no, I'm not quite sure. I got the question a long time ago, and I've been feeling guilty about not answering it because I wasn't really sure what the answer could be. I don't know if there's a moral, is there a moral imperative to stay Calvinist when you hate the doctrines of grace?
If you think it's true.
Well, then you should.
If you think it's true, but you don't like that it's true. Like I think people who have that position on hell sometimes, that they don't have any other option because they know that the Bible teaches it. But they hate that it's true.
So, okay.
But they can't. You can't just decide what you believe based on what you like.
Yes, you can. Literally, everyone does that right now. That's what it is. That's what the world even means. Are you kidding me? That's how it works. I like X, therefore, ergo.
It is true.
It is true. I know that because I'm reading Glennon Doyle Melton's Untamed. I really want to talk about it, but I should read it first. Just the first chapter is so...
Untamed?
Yeah.
What's it about?
How she's actually a cheetah.
What?
So it's fine for her to be a lesbian and blow up her marriage in her life because she is actually a cheetah.
Does she mean cougar?
No. No, I don't. Wait. I don't think so. Are you making some kind of horrible joke?
Well, a cougar is a woman, an older woman who goes after younger men. It's like a cheetah, like a older woman who divorces her husband and goes after other women. Is
that... She's not that old. She's younger than me. How dare you? She left her husband so she could be with Abby, the soccer player.
So why does it make her a cheetah?
Okay, well, she's... Okay, I gotta read the book.
Wait.
Anyway, I thought it was really, really interesting.
Is that cheetah behavior? Is that documented cheetah behavior? Do they?
No.
Cheetahs get married, leave their husbands for soccer players?
No, you can't follow the analogy too far, the metaphor, whatever. It's just that she's
wild at heart. There was a book called Wild at Heart.
We should read that. Somebody wanted us to read that book. Okay, so yeah, she. Do I really want to talk about? Is that one of my hot takes?
Is she a Christian? She quote unquote Christian.
Self-identifies as a Christian. That's
and she left her husband and hooked up with a female soccer player and thinks that's
well, her husband cheated on her, so.
Okay, well, they should. The divorce is certainly within the cards there, but then the other part, hooking up with a female soccer player.
Okay, you got it. Do you want me to tell you the premise of the book? Yeah. So she has been really unhappy her entire life. And so unhappy. She had a lot of addiction issues. She was bulimic. She was in an unhappy marriage. And one day she was at the zoo with her, quote, wife and her children. And they were at the cheetah thing.
Yeah.
And there was the cheetah, and the cheetah was going to run after a pink bunny to show what it could do. So first they had a lab run after the bunny to show the cheetah how it was done. And then they had the cheetah run after the bunny.
A pink bunny?
Like a stuffed bunny.
Oh, okay.
And so then, where did this bunny? Then they let the cheetah go in its enclosure, and the demeanor of the cheetah changed radically. Because when it was running after the bunny for meat, it was sort of, you know, it was kind of grotesque because they'd trained the cheetah to act like Labrador. And so it didn't work very well, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't that awesome. But then when the cheetah was free, in its enclosure, of course, it was still caged, the posture of the cheetah changed. And she thought, well, wouldn't it be great if they let the cheetah go? Because then it could be wild and free. And and she realized, I'm the cheetah.
Oh, my goodness.
And society has constrained me with that all is, of its that is constraining the most, things.
I'm sorry, I'm going to use the word that I can use. Asinine.
Okay, well.
Way of thinking through your life.
What I really liked about it, because I was reading a little bit of it last night, is that I was reading it on Good Shepherd Sunday, where Jesus says, in fact, you're not actually a cheetah, you're a sheep. Yeah. You're not even a
Your
lab.
Spirit animal is a stupid sheep.
Is a sheep. And you are in this book behaving not like a cheetah, but like a goat, actually. But first of all, I don't think you get to pick your spirit animal.
No, I think.
Second of all, it's interesting that she would pick a cheetah because that is actually a very destructive animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not safe. But that she's not safe. Get this. Wait. Mind she's blown. She's not safe.
She's like Aslan.
Only not like Aslan. Anyway, I think it's going to be really great. Okay, Zad, that was my first hot take. You do a hot take now.
Okay, yeah. I want to make everyone angry with me real fast.
Okay.
So there was a thread.
Please don't offend everyone in my life.
I'm not. I'm just going to offend most of the people in your life.
Please don't be racist or...
I'm not a racist.
Misogynist.
I'm not a misogynist.
Or anything bad.
I'm none of those things. I'm a nice person. But...
But...
there was this Facebook thread featuring lots of highly platformed ACNA members yesterday. It started off with a question about you know, why are we not focusing all of our energies and getting more African-American rectors into the ACNA, which is...
I don't think it said all of our energies.
Well, why are we not making that a priority? I think ministry should not be focused on any one demographic, but sure, okay. I mean, we have a pretty diverse, we have a widely diverse denomination, not just with African Americans. We have African, first generation Africans. We have Hispanic or Latino people. We have just a widely diverse
Asian.
Okay. So Asian people. So I don't, the post seemed, the author says he didn't, but it seemed to imply that the ACNA was not focusing enough on diversity. So anyway, and this particular author has a heart for bringing in more African-American rectors into the church, which is fine. Again, no problem with that. But down in the thread, Joshua Steele of the American Compass, Anglican Compass, and Greg Goebbels and Tish Harrison Warren and all those guys were there's the thread developed into something where that, well, what the first thing we need to do is get rid of all those people who are Anglican and vote for Trump because that's racist. It was essentially, if you vote for Trump, somehow that makes you either a racist or an unknowing, complicit person who's complicit with racism. And I guess because Trump is racist, and I think there are certainly racists who vote for Trump. And there are racists who vote for Democrats. But the idea that an Anglican who votes for Trump is necessarily racist is abhorrent and ridiculous. I didn't vote for him the first time around. I probably won't vote for him the second time around. But I can see why you would, because of the commitment to death that the Democratic Party has, the death both of unborn babies, the death of souls through gay marriage. I mean, read Romans 1, and then you can find a description of the Democratic Party there. So I can understand why people would hold their nose and vote for President Trump again, to forestall hell being elected into high office. But part of the argument from the evangelical left is, oh, well, you can't really be pro-life if you vote for somebody who has policies that are not socialist, essentially, that aren't redistributive, that are not aimed toward a more leftist view of the economy and of society. So you're actually killing people by not voting for someone who wants to redistribute wealth. So you're not being pro-life.
I mean, I feel like you should say that in such a way that the other side would actually agree with you.
Well, so, if you promote policies that
but you can't
hurt
do
the
it.
Poor
no,
and
no.
minorities
now, do it
more
in a
than
voice.
Anyone else, you can't call yourself pro-life because
you can't do that voice. You can't do it like that because you're going to tick off your opponent. So say it in such a way that you're.
So Trump, President Trump is not. I'm going to play the other argument out. President Trump is not explicitly racist. He doesn't say I hate black people or I hate Hispanics, but he promotes policies that are to their detriment, and he speaks in a way that his words are kind of a dog whistle for racists. So racists hear him speak and they think, oh, this is one of our guys, and then they go to the rallies where everyone's wearing the red hat, and minorities are sometimes, they say, I don't know what evidence you have, but treated badly. And, you know, you have then someone who is, if not explicitly, implicitly promoting a racist view of the national character. And so a Christian shouldn't vote for that. Whereas the Democrats have programs in place that are aimed to elevate the life of the minority person and the person who's poor. And so when those people are lifted out of poverty, they'll be less likely to have abortions.
I mean, I don't think the Democrats actually do that, but
I think one of the most deadly policies of the last 50 years has been the welfare
genocide.
The supporting of single women with babies in a way that encourages them to remain single and not be married and have more babies in that condition rather than being married and have babies. That just breaks apart the family. I mean, and it happened, and it's not just in minority areas, it's in Appalachia and elsewhere. If the social policy is designed to be more advantageous for those who do not have a job and do not have a family unit, a husband, a wife, then that's what you're going to produce. And that's been horrific. It's had a horrific effect on our country. And so, no, I don't think that the Democratic policies are supportive of minorities or people who are poor. They are enslaving of minorities and people who are poor. And so I think for that reason, in addition to the abject, purposeful pushing of abortion, it's no longer let's make abortion rare and safe. It's let's get as many people to abort their babies as humanly possible. And we're going to fund Planned Parenthood. We're going to send Planned Parenthood into these, into the minority and poor neighborhoods. So I think you vote for the Democratic Party, you're voting for death, just death all around. And you can't do that. But you can't, I mean, I'm not saying you should vote for President Trump either, because I understand. I mean, he's, I still have that conscience twinge that, you know, look with Bill Clinton, none of us could vote for him because he was immoral and dishonest. And so how can we now turn around and vote for President Trump? Except I do get the forestalling argument that you gotta do something to keep.
You just shouldn't do it joyfully.
Right. I don't think there are too many who do though. I don't think there's a lot of people.
No, I mean, there are some though. There are some who are like, this is the best.
Right. Right.
I'm so happy right now.
And but just go ahead and call those who do vote for Trump racist is, I mean, that's just the most.
Because a lot of Anglicans did do it.
Yeah, I mean,
and probably will again.
Anglicans who are saying that.
No, but I mean, a lot of Anglicans did vote for Trump.
Right.
And I don't think it's. I do agree. It's not fair to say that they all are on the side of misogyny and racism because they did that, and that they have no care of other people.
Yeah.
But.
So.
Okay, but I don't feel like it's fair for you to say. People who loathe Trump all want babies to die.
I don't think they do, but I think their calculus is wrong. If the choice is between somebody who does not have any explicit support of racism I think he just says things and.
Yeah, it's not the racism that's the problem.
I think he's thought out a racial policy. I think he just says stuff and he's...
That's why it's so discouraging.
Yeah, and then versus somebody who's explicitly, vocally pushing the murder of unborn babies. I don't see how you can even make a choice between those two. There's an even choice between those two. It's like, so one candidate... favors rounding up and gassing all the Jews.
Okay, stop.
And the other candidate,
you can't.
And the other candidate has says questionable things about racial minorities.
You can't.
Which one do you vote for?
Stop it.
No, that's exact. Okay, I'm sorry. I should apologize to the Nazis because they didn't kill as many people as the abortion industry has killed. Mm-mm. The Nazis only killed 6 million, so they're not as liable as we are for killing 60 million unborn babies in the last 60 years. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I should be careful about leaping to those kind of comparisons.
Gosh, this is a cheerful morning.
I'm sorry.
So glad we came together to do this important podcast.
Yeah.
Is it my turn for a hot take?
It's your hot take, John.
Okay. So I think it's really important to just bring up the question of, can you eat... would you eat human meat grown in a lab? This is from March. And this is important because in order to push along human meat grown in a lab, they're going to do celebrity meat. So first of all, lab grown meat would be an interesting test case pitting consequentialist morality against yuck reaction absolutism. In other words, lab-grown human meat might be ethical in the sense that no one experiences any bad consequences. No killing, no desecrating corpses, but humans might still instinctually recoil at the idea of eating it.
That happens.
Dawkins' question isn't a new one, though research suggests that people getting to eat lab-grown meat at all might be a challenge, and that the market for lab-grown human meat would probably be vanishingly small. Anyway, I'm going to link this meat grown in a petri dish, but that's just the setup, because actually, there is a company, I thought this was a joke, but... Ellen DeGeneres Salami, one company's quest to make meat from celebrity tissue samples. So this company is called Bite Labs, and they're trying to make human test tube meat a reality, and they want to use celebrities to do it. I'm going to link this because it's so great. But anyway, what Bite Labs... they're going to do sample descriptions from James Franco, Kanye West, Jennifer Lawrence, and Ellen DeGeneres. In case you're wondering, DeGeneres' salami is described as black pepper and garlic with a playful kick of mustard. It gives the Ellen salami a highly approachable and well-rounded flavor.
This is
flavor.
Just stomach-turningly gross. This is... Why would you do that? Why don't you get meat made from animals?
Well, because we want to do clean meat. It's not fair to eat animal meat.
What?
There's a thing called clean meat. One possible argument against cannibalism via clean meat could stem from virtue ethics, he said. The idea that people should cultivate attitudes that are virtuous for their own sake. I love that so much.
That's strange. Why would you do that?
I know.
Wait, just a minute. Why? Okay, if we're not actually eating the people, right? We're
taking their cells and making meat from their cells.
Why don't
cells?
We take cow cells and make meat from cow cells?
I read the article carefully enough.
I'm not understanding why it has to be human being cells and not cow cells.
Well, I think it's upsetting for people to have to eat meat or eat animals.
So it's better to eat human beings?
Okay. It says, let's see. What's more, she noted, the study found that vegetarians who already didn't eat meat were among the least likely to say they'd start eating meat if it were lab grown. Similarly, people who don't see the appeal of cannibalism aren't likely to change their minds just because the meat is never part of a living person, she said. Anyway. This is very important, and I just wanted to bring it to your attention. That's my second.
That is the most. I don't understand what on earth. Mm-hmm. Well, there's that guy who was the guy's name.
Yeah, Alex Jones, who was like, "I'm gonna eat my neighbor."
You should put that.
I'm gonna string him up, and I'm gonna eat him
if my daughter's hungry.
Yeah.
What's happened to that?
Okay. So anyway, that's my hot take. I've had two. I've had Glenage Oil Melton and the Eat Meat. Okay, you get another one.
I'm still.
I'm gonna go ahead and suggest that you shouldn't eat meat grown in a lab. Because
I have another hot take. Okay, I have another hot take.
Because, it's not true that it's not consequence free. It'll have some effect on your moral sense. Your moral whatever. Just like I don't think you should eat a veggie burger, like a burger that's made out of vegetables, because it's lying. You should try to... I'm just going to go ahead and do some, like, off of the top of my head ethics here. I think things should look as much as possible like they actually are, instead of...
Like a tofurkey?
Yeah, you shouldn't do a tofurkey. That's immoral. That's almost as immoral as eating... Ellen DeGeneres salami.
I just can't imagine. The thought of this is just horrific.
Apparently, they didn't get permission from these celebrities to use their names. They're just sort of pontificating here.
Oh, okay. So they're not. There's not actually Ellen DeGeneres salami made yet.
I don't think so.
Okay. Okay. Well, that makes me feel a little better. It's just someone. It's a crazy article. It's not really.
Well, I like the idea of Bite Lab. That's the name of it. Okay, go ahead. It's your turn.
Okay. So I'm going back to Anglican world.
Oh, great. Here I am trying to pull us up into anything more interesting.
And so all those people I named a minute ago who are part of that thread, if you don't remember, just back up and go listen to the names again.
No.
I named them already. All of those people are interconnected. Many of them have connections to Tarot Parish.
It sounds like a conspiracy.
And they're just influenced by guys like Tori Balcom. And one of the main thrusts of this group of people, especially with an Anglican compass and the Anglican pastor, is to say that the issue of sexuality is not church dividing, that we can have Christian fellowship with other clergy members, ordained people who are promoting same-sex blessings. And you wonder, how could something like that be embraced by members of the ACNA who have been through this sexuality battle? Well, I'll tell you how, because these guys haven't been through the battle. They're entering into Anglicanism never having fought that out. And they think the war is over. They think that that's something in the past, that sexuality is just, sexuality, the sexuality debate is something that we won. And so now everyone who's really upset about it is just, you know, they're just like old vets who can't get over the war. In reality, the war hasn't even begun yet. The little dust up we had within Anglicanism, within the Episcopal Church, is nothing compared to what's happening within the evangelical world. And even, I think, the Roman Catholic world, and even beginning to happen in the Orthodox world. This thing is going to split churches across the divide. And what we should be doing is promoting ourselves as a denomination that has fought this fight and is able to go into this war prepared, instead of saying, hey, look, this is not something we have to disfellowship over. It is. It is something we have to disfellowship over, and we don't need to find a way to talk about it that is less, what Joshua Steele was saying. We need to find a way to talk about this.
Don't use your voice.
That is.
Use a straight, you're not allowed to talk like that.
We need to talk about this in a way.
No.
That is,
whimsical.
Whimsy. Yeah, we need to use whimsy. When we talk about this. And I think part of it goes down to a theological problem, right? The theological problem is this, is that I think there's a group of younger Anglican clergy who think that salvation is something that takes place when the church is rightly marketing Jesus, when we're rightly presenting the gospel. We're doing so in a way that will make non-believers attracted to Jesus. And so because the LGBT thing is such a huge problem right now, and so divisive in the culture, we need to moderate how we talk about it, and talk about it in soft tones, and show that we can be friends even though we disagree about these things, and that will be more attractive than saying, you know, this is a life in the pit of hell, and everyone who follows it is going, as Saint Paul says, to hell unrepentantly. They're going there. Whereas if you look at the New Testament, you know, the apostles had, and Jesus himself had, no qualms about speaking very, very directly and with sharp edges toward those wolves who were infiltrating the flock. They had no qualms about it at all. They didn't worry about people on the outside seeing that and saying, ooh, I don't want to be part of that group because they're so angry. They didn't care, because what they understood, the justification takes place as a result of the word being preached. God uses his word to bring people to faith. He doesn't need us to be trying to shape the message so that it's attractive to non-believers. He just needs us to be out there and boldly proclaim the message.
Okay, so I don't want to be on board your train right now. I'm not getting on board your train. Your train of whatever it is, but I do think that there's, and I'm seeing this in evangelicalism all over the place, not Anglicanism in particular, but there's a real naiveness, mm-hmm. and I think it comes from thinking that you're still in sort of a reasonable culture, or a Judeo-Christian culture even, rather than one that is completely gutted. So. Yeah. One thing that was interesting about the Episcopal Church, and this is why the fight is still going on, it's not just that we enjoy a fight all the time and we just want to fight. Like, actually, I think most people who went through the Anglican War would like peace.
Absolutely.
But watching it, the storm gather on the cultural, bigger horizon is, you know, so it's really discouraging.
And then here these young 30-something
there's
no problem.
Well, so... But the reason that the people who lived through the Anglican Wars, I think, could be useful in such a time as this is that we did, as children and young adults, and then older people, see how the organization was gutted and what kind of language. So what you need to do if you're not really understanding why people are reacting the way they are, people, old-timey guys, is go and read That Hideous Strength. Read Lewis's Space Trilogy. But read That Hideous Strength again. Because, I read that while we were in between two general conventions, 2003 and 2006. And the way that you think about language the way that you talk about something reflects what you really think about it. So it's not enough to just say, well, we all agree with a biblical sexuality. I'm hearing that everywhere. We all have orthodox biblical sexuality. Yeah. View of people. No, that's not, you can't just say that. There's an iceberg underneath that. And it's not just a sort of a box that you tick. What you believe about human sexuality goes right back to what you think about scripture, mm-hmm. what you think about the church, what you think about God, what you think about salvation. It is not a little box that you tick. Everybody's view of that is open to scrutiny. Yeah. You can't say, well, he or she
confesses
biblical sexuality. Nope. Look at the substance of what they're saying. Look at the details. Mm-hmm. Examine their life and the content of their preaching carefully, because fractures come in all over the place, and then suddenly you open the box one day and there's nothing.
I have no doubt that, you know, Joshua Steele and others have an orthodox view of human sexuality itself. What they don't have an orthodox view of is how to deal with those who are subverting that orthodoxy. They, if you really had an orthodox biblical view of how to speak of and deal with sexual sin and heresy, then you would also have a much more pointed assessment of people in the Episcopal Church or people in the evangelical world who are promoting sexuality within the church. You would not sit back and say, let's try to find a more whimsical way to talk about it. That's not what the apostles did. That's not what Jesus did. The apostles, John said, hey, if someone comes to you and is running ahead of the apostles, not bringing the teaching of Christ, don't even greet him. Don't even bring him into your house. Don't even give the barest hospitality. In fact, to do such a thing is to participate in his wicked work. Paul said, you know, if someone's engaging in sexual activity outside of marriage, whether it be heterosexual or homosexual, that person, unless that person repents, is not going to enter the kingdom of heaven. And so what are the people who are promoting that doing? This is not just an issue over which we can disagree, because they're actively sending people to hell. This is not a small issue. This is not something we've got to figure out how to use the right language about and nuance and be careful not to cause offense. Where are you coming from? What do you think this is? Now, interestingly, when this topic is switched to something like race, then it's all hard edges, right? Then for them, it's all, you shouldn't even be an Anglican if you're going to vote for Trump. So they can say stuff like that, but at the same time, you know, being blasé about a soul-destroying, hellish theology, that tells you how little discernment these people have. And how little.
I don't think you should say things like these people. You shouldn't say these people.
Okay, well.
They're your brothers and sisters in Christ.
That shows you how little discernment my brothers and sisters in Christ have.
There you go.
Who are promoting this thing.
Okay, it is, I don't relish the idea of you in particular, because I'm just going to divide myself from you as I have all morning, being such a mean guy. But I guess one heartbreak about the Episcopal Church was being in trouble for so many years. Like mentality, but posture. It's more like your stance on the balls of your feet. And it's not delightful. It's not fun, but I blogged this week. I don't think it's helpful in any kind of, debate that's going on to wonder about the feelings of the people. Why are they? And I don't think you should do, I don't think you have done this when you're arguing with people. Like,
Well, part of the day is not assuming that they're debating their position because they have a certain emotional thing going on.
Yeah. Like, it needs to stay in the realm of theology.
So that's what happened. The big ACNA page, Facebook page, I was arguing about this, saying, look, we can't be we can't be friends with people who are promoting same-sex abortion. And one of the highly platformed person I've already named, female, came in and said, well, I see that you're really hurt about this.
We need to not come
this question from a place of pain and hurt and your past experiences. And, you know, I just knew about, you know, what? Are you too obtuse to actually deal with an issue? You have to deal with emotions?
No, don't say words like obtuse. That's not helpful.
Well then.
We are trying to help people stay married. So you are not allowed to use words like always and never, or are you too? Okay.
That response communicated to me.
There you go.
I felt like that person was not able to deal in a rational, coherent way with a theological issue. And it sounded like instead of doing that, this person has decided to shove it off into the realm of emotions and psychology.
Vast assumptions about what that person might be.
Well, I mean, if that person could engage the actual issue, then I welcome that person to do so.
That person might want people to come into the church and might be really anxious about the health of the church and may not, have a lot of, may not actually be acting from very evil motivations to destroy everything. I'm just suggesting that.
Oh, I'm sure she's not acting from evil motivations. I would not question
her
motivations.
But you did.
I did. No, I know. I questioned her capacity to deal with the question.
And that's actually
since
worse.
She didn't. I mean, if she would deal with the question, I'd be happy to. I mean, I'll be happy to revise my assessment.
Okay, but I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Okay, it's my turn. I get my last hot take because you are just bombing this podcast. It's really important right now in this critical time to think about your credibility bookcase. It's from the New York Times. The bookcase has become the preferred background for applying a patina of authority to an amateurish video feed.
Yeah.
So imagine that you are a member of the expert class, the kind of person invited to pontificate on television news programs. Under normal circumstances, your expertise might be signaled to the public by a gaudy photograph of skyscrapers superimposed behind your head. But now the formalities of broadcast studio are a distant memory and the only tool to convey that you truly belong on television are all the objects within your own home. And there's only one move. You must talk in front of a bookcase. So I'm pretty happy.
I do that.
Yeah. It's important to have
a bookcase. Yeah.
But this person is trying to say it's actually, I think, like a tool of capitalism.
So what should you have, like a red banner or something behind you, or like
treating a book as a purely aesthetic object is often seen as an affront to intellectual credibility. That's true. You can buy, like,
you know, but if you actually the books and you read them, and it's not just, I mean, if you buy the books just to color code them on your color code,
well, that's what some people do.
Well, you've done that in one of our bookshelves.
I did color code. I just wanted to see what would happen.
Yeah, it really bothers me.
It's kind of interesting how it looks. But it's only one bookshelf out of like the 500 that we have or whatever. I thought it looked sort of cool.
I think, so you can't like the way books look? You can't being aesthetically pleased by the way books look is bourgeois? Is that
I think it's bougie, but also I guess, I don't know, I'm going to link this. The credibility bookcase, I don't agree with this. With its towering idiosyncratic array of worn volumes, is itself an affectation. That's not true. Not if you read all the books.
Yeah. I mean, if you buy them just to set up the set.
That is an affectation. Right. But if you actually did read them.
Right.
So the expert could choose to speak in front of his art prints or his television or his blank white walls, but he chooses to be framed by his books. It is the most insidious of aesthetic trends. One that masquerades as pure intellectual exercise.
I think we should do next things in front of bookshelves.
I bet this person doesn't have books and hasn't read them. And so it's just bitter because
need to practice your own preaching at me just now.
I feel like this person's criticism of me sitting in front of my books is, which, yeah. Okay. Stop watching that video
There's a video. You should put this on our place. This monkey drives up in a
motorcycle, and then it's a tiny motorcycle.
He has to take away a toddler.
But then the video stops. Like, where's the person videoing?
This is the man that's coming to get, save the toddler.
It's like really.
I mean,
that is so weird. Where does a monkey get a tiny motorcycle?
I don't.
So that's a tiny motorcycle.
That's a really tiny motorcycle.
Anyway, do you want to say anything nice to people in your own church as your last hot take?
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you mean? What did you have a
sentence? Do you want to say anything like, I really love you. I don't think you should be pushed out of the church.
Well, no one in our church is doing this. I mean, okay, if we had a parishioner who was actually promoting sexual sin, like saying, hey, guys, you should all go commit adultery and it's fine if you sleep around with people of the same sex, then I think I would have to have a gentle conversation with that person and say, look, you need to repent. But no one's doing that. So I will say to my people who listen to me that if you hear in my voice irritation and frustration and anger, there's a reason for that, because I love you. And I don't want anything to hurt you. And it, the same kind, you know, yesterday we preached about preached on Psalm 23. And there's that great image of Jesus with the rod and the staff. And why does he have the rod? He has the rod to beat wolves away from the flock. And every under shepherd has to do that too. We have no choice. And if I'm not angry about heresy, because it kills people and it destroys souls. If I'm not angry, I'm not, and insofar as I'm not angry, I'm not reflecting Christ, because he hates heresy. He hates anything that destroys his people and it harms them. And so that's why you hear this tinge in my voice. Imagine if you could, I mean, I've used this image before. If you want to maybe get a sense of it, like imagine you see your children playing outside and then someone drives up who you don't know, and
like starts, that tiny little monkey,
and say, yeah, right, and starts pulling them into his car. How would you feel? I mean, you wouldn't want to have gracious conversation. You'd want to run out there and beat that guy to pulp and take your kids back.
Okay, but so it's not that there's no emotion in this. Mm. That, like, so people say, why are you so angry?
Right, there is, but there, it's not emotion because we've been hurt. It's emotion because you love the people who are being hurt.
That's an important distinction. Right. Just wanted to give you the opportunity to make it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
I feel like this podcast is like, it's going to be bad. I don't think you're going to endear yourself to the world.
I'm going to share it around all the different places.
I'm going to hide. So we'll be beloved. Okay, I just do have a PSA.
Okay.
It's very unlikely that I'll be blogging this month. Maybe I will, but I'm not making any pronouncements. But I'm going to finish my book as fast as I can. And that means I'm old now. I know that when I wrote my book in the first place, I was able to keep blogging and write it and homeschool and all that stuff, but I've aged. I think I've gone past my intellectual peak. I'm not as smart as I was back in the day. And, I'm really fighting with my own mind to get this book done. So that's part one. And then part two, like the death of our cat is really, well, our cat died on Thursday. And then the cat that we loved so much, our consolation cat, ran away. Yeah.
It was very horrible. Yesterday. Saturday.
And so we're really sad and wandering around the neighborhood looking for her. And so it may be that life gets more complicated when you go out and buy like a big pile of kittens or something, which would be a bad idea right now. Bad way to console our sadness. So I'm not sure about the blogging. And if I don't blog or don't do videos much this month of May, it's not because I don't love you or the internet or anything. It's just because I'm fighting my own tiny mind, my tiny, shrinking, decrepit, aging mind. So
I think you have a beautiful mind.
Oh, okay. I just think you should, there's nothing you can do now to make this better. But anyway, I hope you all turn in next week because maybe we'll still be here.